Welcome to Series 3 of The Great Humbling. What does it mean to be humbled? Perhaps it's to be less proud, to feel less important, even a little defeated. From the Latin humus, ground, to be grounded, and humilis, brought to the ground, made low or lowly. My name's Ed Gillespie, and I'm a poet, futurist, and recovering sustainability consultant. In the early days of the pandemic, I started recording these conversations with the author Dugald Hine, where we wonder together about the strangeness of the times we're in, the altered states into which they push us, and now, in this third series, the new moves that might be called for, if these really are times of being brought back down to earth. So, episode 3 of series 3. Dugald, what has been on your mind this week?
Well, it's always good to hear back from people who've been listening. I had a message just now from Liz Slade, who said she'd really enjoyed episode 2, although she did feel a bit jealous of both of our new homes. There was a great comment from Michael Reynolds in New Zealand, someone who I got to know through the Homeward Bound series that I taught last spring. And he writes, "I noticed a train of thought developing, and noticing of how often the responses or projects we create have a singular future vision or pathway woven into them. They seem to come from either end of a spectrum that straddles perfectionism at one end and reactionary response at the other. A question sits with me. How do we reside somewhere more in the middle, in the land of holding the hope and possibility of a multitude of paths and outcomes, guided by a faith and trust in an honest and humble sense or experience of love of the worlds we inhabit?" I want to just acknowledge that as a particular kind of question, a question that's not in need of an answer exactly, but a question that's worth holding or sitting with, as Michael puts it, carrying for a while, seeing what comes into view as a result. So thank you for that one, Michael. And everyone, we love hearing back from you about the thoughts or connections these conversations have sparked. Ed, anything you've been hearing back from listeners this week?
Yeah, well, I had a nice message from Richard Brophy, who previously said he could listen to the two of us for hours. So I sort of said to him, be careful what you wish for, Richard. But he said when all this is over, it would be really great to hear us both do one of these discussions live by a fire with glasses of whiskey beneath centuries old oak beams creaking with memory. And I really rather like the sound of that. And especially as we reminded ourselves this week that in the conviviality of these conversations, it's easy to forget we've never met in person. So on the back of Richard's thought, I'm carrying that fire-lit, whiskey-fueled, creaky-beamed image of the two of us together into this week.
In fact, let's say it now. We'll do that live session at the pub of the Long Now when I finally make it to England again. And if you're listening to this, then consider yourselves invited. Speaking of fireside chats, we also had a chat this week with someone who got in touch after episode 1 of this series, Pete Lawrence, who's the co-founder of the Big Chill Festival. These days, his main project is something called Campfire Convention, which is setting out to create a different kind of social network. So we were talking because they're going to put this podcast out on Campfire Radio, which is something they're launching this spring. But that conversation got me thinking more generally about how the shape of the internet has been changing, what we want from these technologies, and what feels alive in the ways we're using them just now. So I guess that's something that I'll come back to this week. But firstly, Ed, we're doing new moves. We've had Keep It Foolish. We've had Move Your Ass. Do you want to introduce this week's instruction?
I certainly do. This week's instruction, everyone, is be like water. So this week we're going to be exploring flow, immersion, the waters of refreshment and the weed-clogged pools in this liquid life.
I've got a story that I have to tell to start us on this particular theme. Appropriately enough, it starts on water, on a ferry. It's the summer of 1997. And in those days, you could catch a passenger ferry from Norway and wake up the next morning sailing into the port of Tyne. And I'm 19 years old. I'm on that boat heading home to the northeast of England where I grew up at the end of 10 months travelling around Europe, hitchhiking and busking. And there are two other backpackers in the lounge on the ship. We gravitate towards each other, fall into conversation in a way that I think was easier when no one was carrying laptops or smartphones to soak up those moments of spare time. The journey that they'd been on made my 10 months traveling around Europe seem pretty tame. They'd hitched up the coast of one continent and across two more. And the next morning, as we said our farewells, one of them reached into her backpack and pulled out this photocopied pamphlet. It was a zine she'd made, a zine called Doris. And it was full of stories, handwritten or typed and pasted up. And they were stories that read like secrets, big secrets about how fucked the world is, and small secrets about the beauty that endures in the middle of it all anyway. And her name was Cindy Crabb. Years later, I discovered quite how much her zine had mattered to people. You can get a collected volume called The Encyclopedia of Doris. And Cindy's papers are archived at the Arthur and Elizabeth Schlesinger Library on the History of Women in America at Harvard University. And I found a review at Zine Nation when I was looking back at her work this week, which says, "It's not an overstatement to say that Doris is one of the most important and influential fanzines ever written." I didn't have a clue about any of this. It was the first zine I'd ever seen, but it was exactly the inspiration that I needed as I was on that threshold of coming home. And the truth is that the publication I put together over the next few weeks, using the desktop publishing software on my dad's computer, didn't have that much in common with the zine that had inspired it. Yes, I'd written some stories from my travels and put them together with some poems, but I'd rounded up everyone else I could find in my hometown who would admit to writing to fill the pages of this thing, and it did have a title. I couldn't have told you back then what it meant. It was called Learning How to Drown. A few months later, I'm selling copies of the latest issue on the door of my best friend's gig at Darlington Arts Centre. And a girl takes a copy, inspects it, and reads from the cover, "Learning How to Drown, Issue 3. And then she hands it back and she says, "If it was any good, you'd only need one issue."
Yeah, and that's the kind of feedback that's hard to argue with.
Absolutely. It's the most unanswerable critical verdict I've ever been on the receiving end of.
I don't know about learning how to drown. Maybe that's a gift we all have under the wrong circumstances. Maybe it's learning how to drown well, or perhaps in the mythic sense, learning how not to drown in a well. I did my usual etymological explorings on water. Water comes to us from the Old English water, of Germanic origin. And it was obviously related to other Germanic languages like Dutch water or vata and German Wasser. But interestingly, then it goes back to an Indo-European root, which is also shared by the Russian for water, which is voda, very similar to vodka. But also from the Latin unda, which means wave, and Greek huda, which means water too. So there was something intriguing that the Russians have that vodka voda type of angle, which then reminded me of my years in Scotland and, you know, the Gaelic ushkabar, the water of life, for all our lyrical libations. Having done the etymology, it was obvious then that any talk about being like water had to acknowledge Bruce Lee, who is famously associated with the phrase. I was doing a bit of contextual research around that, and there's a great quote from Bruce which said, "In order to control myself, I must first accept myself by going with and not against my nature." And apparently this was inspired by his martial arts teacher, a guy called Yip Man, who had said to the young Bruce, "Preserve yourself by following the natural bends of things and don't interfere. Remember never to assert yourself against nature. Never be in frontal opposition to any problems, but control it by swinging with it." And then he said, don't practice your martial arts this week. Just go home and think about it, which in itself is a wonderful thing. You know, don't just do something, sit there. Bruce spent many hours thinking and meditating and then went sailing alone in his junk. And whilst at sea, getting increasingly frustrated with, you know, understanding this advice, in frustration, he punched the water. And it was then that he had this revelation. You know, he had not hurt the water with his punch. He couldn't grasp it in his fist. He couldn't sever or divide it from itself. And to Lee, that water then encapsulated the very essence of Kung Fu, something shapeless that could create beautiful forms. You know, whether that's snowflakes to waterfalls, it's the softest substance that could yet penetrate the hardest. You know, steam can split rock, glacial ice carves mountains, from raging torrents to these calm, limpid pools, or the roaring ocean waves that humble even the biggest vessels, or equally a serene surface that mirrors back the images cast upon it. And obviously, Be Like Water became one of the mantras of the Hong Kong protests over the last couple of years. And there's something very powerful about the way that that movement was able to adopt that philosophy and to spring up and pop up and move and outmaneuver, to be fair, a lot of the Chinese government's attempts to constrain and constrict it. Although obviously the rather brutal crackdown, which is now trying to put a containment vessel around that movement using the very, very strong arm of the law and intimidation and arrests and incarceration. But I can't help thinking and wondering whether that's just a containment for now, you know, and this is just a legal pressure vessel which is being put around it, whether it will explode again or whether it will just rust slowly from the inside out remains to be seen. The other thing that Lee observed was that the thoughts and emotions that we experience should pass like the reflections of birds that were flying past overhead when he was on his junk on the water. I remember being advised something similar when I was preparing for a wilderness vigil alone on a mountain in the Pyrenees, where my guide said, the biggest danger you face on the mountain is yourself. And he drew a very simple image with a stick in the dirt about the metaphorical stream of consciousness. And we talk about this, but he actually said, you know, try and mentally visualize your thoughts and fears as the flotsam and jetsam in the river of your mind. And rather than dragging them out onto the bank for interminable scrutiny, to actually observe them and then let them bob past downstream, because more are sure to follow.
Well, I'm going to have to admit my ignorance and that I was not initiated into the ways of Bruce Lee as I should have been in my upbringing. But the first thing that comes to mind for me, we talk about being like water, is the Tao Te Ching. And my old friend Charlie Davies made a version of it called, I thought I was on the way to work, but I was on the way home. And Charlie basically read all of the English translations of the Tao that he could get his hands on and then wrote something where he said, I want to avoid any temptation to using resonant words where I couldn't really tell you what I mean by it. And his version of chapter 8 starts like this. Water knows the way. It can flow anywhere without trying. And it gives life to everything. It ends up in the lowest places and brings them life. I love that image of the humbleness of water, always seeking the lowest places.
I love that too, the kind of deep seeping creep into the beneath. That brought to mind a line for me from the poet Mary Oliver, where she said, it's the nature of stone to be satisfied, but it's the nature of water to want to be somewhere else. And I think that notion of flow that Charlie's kind of talking about and that humble creep, it's the blessed unrest. It's the restlessness of water's hungry exploration and movement. And maybe water just has terrible FOMO, fear of missing out, or a nagging doubt that all the fun is happening elsewhere or beneath, downstream somewhere.
The Mary Oliver quote makes me think about a conversation with the glass artists Monica Guggisberg and Philip Baldwin, who I've been working with, and we did this book called Walking in the Void together. And at a point when we were working on that, I was hanging out with them and they were going, look, you have to understand that different materials call to different people according to their temperaments. And it's a bit like dogs and their owners and how they seem to match each other. So stone, you know, that's patience and slowness and steadiness, because it's a piece of work where you can go off and have your lunch and come back and pick up where you left off with that material. Working with metal is this kind of heat and strength and cunning of the forge. And so then Philip's like, basically glass people are all speed freaks. I'm like, right, okay. I'm starting to get it here. But I've been sort of wrestling since then with the question of what exactly the material I work with is, whether it's words or stories or relationships, and whether it responds and resists in ways that bring me to a recognition of the gap between how I thought the world was and how it actually is, which is the thing that I envy in people who work with physical materials.
Yeah, you're like the language of the olive oil slathered leather trousered Turkish wrestler, you know, impossible to totally pin down.
There's an image that I have never previously had of myself. Well, I did write to another friend this week who's deep in Taoism, and I said we're talking about being like water. So that's the artist and Tai Chi teacher, Caroline Ross. And she sent me a whole set of poems and passages from different books by Taoist authors. And then she wrote, in Taoism, water can signify both the highest good and danger. It can signify the exemplary method of non-contention and also the treachery and inescapability of boggy ground, an analogy for overthinking, dwelling on the mundane, or over-involvement in human affairs. Mm. What struck me there is the way that a language of images allows for a multiplication of meanings and possibilities, a set of contrasting implications, all attached to the same word, the same image, and how this allows for a subtlety in the ways we speak. And it's a subtlety that's lacking from the ways in which language tends to get used in the super contentious, word-dominated spaces of the internet, where anything you say is liable to get taken down and used against you. That made me think of the Swedish dramatist Stina Oskarsson, who wrote a few years ago about the need to be able to prove, prata, to test speak, to put a thought into words without being tied to it, to try out how it sounds, and how often that's lacking from the way in which conversation takes place now over these technologies.
That's exactly what Tyson Yunkaporta talks about in Sound Talk, isn't it? It's like that test speak, the sparring around the fire of the conversations which help illuminate different shadows and darknesses.
Right. And I have this recollection, which I don't think is just rose-tinted glasses and nostalgia, of how when the social internet came along, it felt like, gathering around the campfire. It had this exciting, improvisatory quality, you know, because at first, the public internet had been mainly a digitized version of the library and the postal service and the shopping mall. You took things that you did in the physical world and did them instead without having to leave your screen. And obviously, we've had a whole lot more of that in the years since, not least during this pandemic. But there was this sense around, I guess around sort of 2004, 2005 for me was when it hit, of the internet turning into a space where you came into contact with strangers on new terms, a space where you could try things out. And there was this encouragement to narrate your life. Logging into Facebook in like 2007, and being greeted each time by that box that asked, what's on your mind? It was like a cue to writing stories and to seeing your life as a story you were telling. And maybe that was actually a little bit like each of us having a zine. Mm. Now, I definitely remember Twitter in 2009, at the point when it was first starting to catch light. And an old colleague from the BBC sent me an email asking me to explain it to him. And I wrote that it's like It's like having this endless rolling pub conversation that you can drop in and out of, where the playfulness holds open these threads of connection along which you can also send out requests for help when you need it. That was genuinely my experience at that point. It felt like this great serendipity machine through which I was meeting fascinating people and stumbling into encounters that often spilt off the internet into face-to-face, you know, first life. And we touched on this last series when we did State of Anger, but it is hard to compare what Twitter is now to that early experience. I guess you could say that the pub went downhill and it's full of people hitting each other over the head with verbal 2x4s, piling on whichever poor fool's turn it is to get smashed up today. And by 2017, I just stopped going there. I remember being asked to give a lecture around that time at Uppsala University on a course about technology and society. And I asked the students how many of them had social media accounts, how many of them had smartphones. And I said, I'm wondering if there'll be fewer people putting their hands up if I was to come back and ask the same question in 5 years' time. It was just a hunch or a speculation about what it might look like if there was an exodus from Facebook or whatever. I guess the hunch was that the end of Facebook isn't just a repeat of what happened when Facebook replaced MySpace. There isn't one new platform that we're all going to exit to. But I was thinking about that after the conversation we had with Pete Lawrence this week, and thinking, actually, we're starting to see what this looks like.
And when you described this to me the other day, you talked about the dark forests that lie beyond the failed states of the major platforms. And that really resonated with me.
Okay, so this image comes from the Chinese science fiction writer Liu Cixin. And it's his answer to the Fermi paradox, which is this famous question of, if there is intelligent life out there on other planets in the rest of the universe, why haven't we seen any aliens yet? So Liu says, imagine going for a walk in the forest at night and it's dead quiet. And you might assume that this silence is an absence of life. But really, it's everyone hiding from the predators. Like, the silence is how you survive. And a couple of people in the last 2 or 3 years have taken this image and applied it to what's been happening to the internet. There's a piece from Yancey Strickler that set out this dark forest of the internet argument that online space has become this conflict-ridden zone, and more of us are going dark, you know, retreating from our Facebooks and Twitters to other kinds of online space. And Strickler's piece is also basically a warning about this. He's saying, you know, we're abandoning the public squares to the worst kind of people. And I want to say I'm not sure I'd buy that. If we go with a watery image here, it seems to me that Facebook is like a stagnant canal or a lake full of algal bloom. It's not that I don't go there. I take the boat of my work through those channels when it needs to travel that way. But it's not the part of my online life where I expect to find things coming alive. And if I ask where the life is on the internet these days, it feels like it's moved from blogs to newsletters. And it's in the surprisingly slow quality of a lot of the podcasts that I listen to. And it's in the smaller chosen communities that have some context of relationship that holds you to a desire to understand what the other person is trying to say rather than simply to jump to the most hostile conclusion about it. So just playing on that a bit further, think about newsletters. Like, imagine 5 years ago, I'd said to you, you know what the big thing on the internet in 2020 is going to be? It's going to be paying people to send you more email.
Now that'll be the day.
Right. But, you know, that's Substack. And there are half a dozen people whose newsletters I subscribe to like that. And as someone who's been writing an occasional newsletter for nearly 7 years, I think part of it is that when you publish on a blog, when you're out there on Twitter, if you have even a modest audience, everything you write is a chance for someone to jump in the comments and try to ride on your following to get attention. So every response is only partly what it seems to be, and at least partly a performance. Whereas when I send out Crosslines, which is the newsletter I write every now and then, you know, every time it goes out, people write back. And the only person who will see their response is me. So it's a different kind of move they're making. And I'll say the thing that matters most to me in my online life just now, I mean, obviously, aside from these conversations that you and I have, Ed, is the monthly gathering on Zoom with the 30 or so people who came through last year's Homeward Bound series and decided to travel further with me and Anna as part of this school called Home. Just seeing that collection of faces each month, many of whom are people who I have never met outside of a Zoom window. I felt this deepening into trust and agency, and there's a way that that begins to slip past the limitations these technologies normally have. So if I still have some faith in these network tools, it's in the ways we use them that run against the grain of scale and transactions and going viral and all the stuff we're meant to care about. Because I think the life is elsewhere, in these little pockets at the margins or below the radar. I don't think that's a problem. I think that's okay.
I totally connect with that, because that notion of change always coming from the edge, you know, it plays to that idea that if you're looking for the next Facebook, either you're probably asking the wrong question or you're seeking the answer in the wrong place. It's a bit like how our old friend Vinny Gupta memorably described Bitcoin. You know, he said it's capitalism and the solution to capitalism unlikely to be more capitalism. But to bring it back to a watery metaphor, and perhaps another Mary Oliver passage where she is sipping at the source of water. And she writes, "A blackwater pond, the tossed waters have settled after a night of rain. I dip my cupped hands. I drink a long time. It tastes like stone, leaves, fire. It falls cold into my body, waking the bones. I hear them deep inside me, whispering, oh, what is that beautiful thing that just happened?" And when you're talking about, you know, those different fringe and intimate parts of the internet, I get that same evocative image and feeling of fresh chilled water entering our bodies. You know, the flavours of rock and peat and smoke that anyone who's drunk from a wild water source would recognise, and that Mary's articulating so wonderfully. And that's perhaps how these newsletters, these new self-selected communities and relationships feel in the peripheries of that mad toxicity of the internet. They are the refreshing bone-waking waters beyond the chlorinated Olympic-sized swimming pool that has a deeply treacherous shallow end.
There was a thought that was just slipping past me there. Let me see if I can catch it. Yeah, here's what it is. We are thirsty. And there are things that happen sometimes through these machines that eat our attention and dominate our lives, which also quench a thirst. And I feel like we need to be paying attention to that, noticing how rare it is, how different it feels to a lot of the activities that go on through our screens and phones and keyboards and the rest of it. And gently carrying with us the question of how do I cultivate more of that? How do I notice? It's like the vital compass that Vanessa Andreotti talks about, steering by that sense of where the life is. It makes me think of another time when I was asked to teach in Uppsala, and for some reason they wanted me to talk about scaling and evaluating projects for social change. And I said, this really isn't the language that I use. But let's have a conversation about it. What might we be talking about with these things? And so I asked the group, does scale matter? And what came out in the discussion was, well, there are at least two reasonable arguments. You can say the mess the world is in is so deep and so urgent that unless what you're working on can reach a billion people, you might as well not bother. And you can say all the large systems we have are so bound up with why we're in this mess that the best thing to do is to work on a small scale and to try and be like the rats running around under the feet of the dinosaurs. And I said, I think the only stupid argument is the one where we pretend we can settle this one way or the other. Because none of us knows how it's all going to look in hindsight. You can't see the significance of a thing at the time, because its significance lies in what comes afterwards. It's back to that Faulkner line that I was quoting last week. The past isn't even past. So we can be over here in these seemingly insignificant pockets. And maybe the key is that what we're doing has to have life in it anyhow, without counting on how significant it may or may not turn out to be in hindsight.
Which sort of brings us on to flow, actually. And flow was something, the concept of flow beyond rivers was something I first came across about a decade or so ago, back in my Futera days. And it comes to us from the Hungarian-American professor, the wonderfully monikered Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, which is a name to haunt a dyslexic's worst nightmares.
I'm glad you were the one who tried pronouncing it.
Oh, yeah. Pronouncing it, try spelling it. But his famous work is on the psychological state of flow. I mean, he has a pretty extraordinary life story. He lost his two brothers in the siege of Budapest and in a Siberian labour camp. His father was the post-war Hungarian ambassador to Italy. But then when the communists took over Hungary in 1949, a bit like the Myanmar ambassador to the UK, this week being locked out of his own embassy by the military junta, Mihaly's father was expelled, ended up opening a restaurant in Rome, and then the young Mihaly made his way to the US and began a career that focused actually on the processes of happiness and creativity. The way he describes it, he said, flow is all about being in the zone or in the groove. It's a state of complete and content absorption where we're concentrating, you know, we're immersed, where we're touching on all of the intrinsic motivations, where the ego falls away and thoughts follow seamlessly, even musically on from one another like jazz. And he says achieving flow is all about striking the right balance between the level of challenge and skill, because if the task you're embarking on is too hard, then anxiety and worry sometimes sets in. And if it's too easy, you drift into boredom and apathy. And I think there are three aspects of the way he describes flow which are of a special interest to us. One is the paradox of control, the transformation of time, you know, this idea of the long now and the circularity and non-linearity of time, and also the loss of self-consciousness. And I think these are themes that we keep coming back to, which, according to Mihaly, lead to what he calls autotelic experiences. An autotelic derives from the Greek autoteles and is formed from autos for self and telos for goal. So it's like about a self goal. So he describes this as the internal drivers, the purpose within itself. So it's not about the external recognition or rewards or the going viral or all of that. And he describes the autotelic person as someone who needs few material possessions and little entertainment, comfort, power or fame, because so much of what he or she does is already rewarding. Because such persons experience flow in work, in family life, when interacting with other people, when eating, even when alone with nothing to do, they depend less on external rewards that keep others motivated to go on with a life of routines. So they're more autonomous and independent because they cannot be as easily manipulated with threats or rewards from the outside. And at the same time, they are more involved with everything around them because they are fully immersed in the current of life.
I was listening to you talk about that and you kept calling him Mihaly. And I was like, oh, wow, does Ed know this guy? And I was like, no, he's just trying to avoid having to try and say that surname more than once.
Csikszentmihalyi.
Oh, well done. No, but seriously, I was thinking as well about the difference between the kind of absorption that is talking about and the state that we easily get into when we're flicking through our feeds on our phones. There's a kind of zombie version, a kind of toxic mimic of flow that might be part of what, when we're honest about it, I think troubles most of us about our relationships to these networked technologies. I mean, Ed, would you say that you're an autotelic person?
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, I would aspire to be. I think you're right. I think when I'm perhaps self-consciously policing the toxic mimics in my own life, then yes, I often find joy in experiences and situations that others might find uncomfortable or miserable. And I think sitting with discomfort has been much more rewarding for me. And if it's still associated with dopamine, I think there's something interesting here, because clearly the scrolling and the feedback and the likes and all of the other activities which are about those external validations and endorsements, we know that there's a sort of dopamine loop there. And I wonder whether there's a difference to that, which is more of the serotonin and the oxytocin that comes from the deeper empathy and the richness that you get from the other types of interactions. So there's still a lot of neurotransmitters, but perhaps they're the slightly less addictive ones, the slower burn, if you like, which might be the ones which are ultimately more nourishing. How about you? Are you an autotelic person, Diggle?
I was reading about this when you were sending me through stuff about flow during the week, and then noticing, hearing other people describe things that relate to it. I was going, when I do my best work, it has that quality. And thinking about it, reading about it, talking about it is a reminder to attend to what goes on in the way I set my life up, the way I set my day up, that gets in the way of or makes space for that. I was awake last night, not able to sleep because we'd done this book launch for Walking in the Void over Zoom. And I was kind of still buzzing from it, but also thinking about how I've said yes to too many things that I need to work on this spring. And this phrase just kind of rang in my head like a bell. The work that is mine to do. When I'm doing the work that is mine to do, I am in flow. And the reason I have to get better at saying no to some of the things that are a little bit kind of like sort of the stuff that I feel like I ought to be doing aren't the work that is mine to do, is because otherwise the work that is mine to do gets squeezed to the point where I'm trying to force it instead of flowing with it. I think that's the honest answer.
I think hopefully a lot of people would connect to that idea as well, the work that is ours to do. We've talked a lot about metaphors of flow and being like water. I wanted to bring in Roger Deakin, his pioneering work through his book Waterlog and the practice of his life, actually, in the context of wild swimming. And I'm good friends with Dan Start, who has written many of the wild swimming guides, who took much of his inspiration from Roger's work. I've had many naked adventures with Dan in autumnal Snowdonian lakes, going again, naked for some reason, into abandoned manganese mines and sharing various favourite swimming holes, both fresh and salty water around the UK. But there's clearly something in this. You know, Kate Rue, who is the founder of the Outdoor Swimming Society, said, you know, they've now got 25,000 members. To the point around immersion, for Deakin, that was a practice and pleasure that was manifold. You know, it was about so many different things. Curiosity and a sort of experiential education and learning. And he writes, you know, I grew convinced that following water, flowing with it, would be a way of getting under the skin of things, of learning something new. And I might learn about myself too. And he says it's, you know, it's about this reconnection. In some ways, a regression, perhaps to our deepest aquatic ape roots, and even back to, you know, some far-flung marine mammal ancestor. Because he says, well, you know, when you swim, you feel your body for what it mostly is, water. And it begins to move with the water around it. So it's no wonder we feel such sympathy for beached whales, because we are beached ourselves at birth. To swim is to experience how it was before we were born. And that stirred in me one of my favorite all-time quotes from philosopher Alan Watts, where he said, you know, you were not born into this world, but out of it, like a wave from an ocean. And Deakin says, you know, a swimming journey would give me access to that part of our world, which, like darkness, mist, woods, or high mountains, still retains most mystery. It would afford me a different perspective on the rest of landlocked humanity.
Makes me think of Lucy Neal, the author of Playing for Time, Making Art as If the World Matters, who's another ardent enthusiast for outdoor swimming. And she quotes one of the older members of Tooting Beck Lido Swimming Club, where she goes, who says, "You never meet a miserable cold water swimmer." So here's a thought to bring things around. I know I can barely get through an episode without talking about Vanessa Andreotti's work, but the first time I met Vanessa was at a gathering here in Sweden 3 years ago called Climate Existence. And she gave a talk called Existence Beyond the House That Modernity Built. And we'll put a link to that video of that in the show notes. And among all the things she said, there was one that stuck with me in particular. She's talking about what you can do when you're in trouble, and how this can be a function of how deep in trouble you are. She says, "Where I come from in Brazil, people say when there's a flood coming and the water's up to your ankles, you can't start swimming. When the water's up to your knees, still no point in swimming. When the water reaches your ass, it's time to start swimming." And it's like, sometimes things have to get bad enough before the impossible becomes possible.
I think my ass is wet.
Too much information, Ed. No, there's one more image that I've heard from Vanessa that's kind of stranger and more uncomfortable even than that one. She's talking about hospicing modernity, you know, what I call the journey through the end of the world as we know it into the unknown world that lies ahead. And she says, when the ship is going down, we have to learn to breathe water. It makes no sense. Like, I can feel a bit of me panicking at an instruction like that. And when I was thinking about it again this week, I thought, this is exactly what the instruction is to those of us who are coming from these low intensity struggles, as we talked about in episode one. And sooner or later, we have to surrender to the unimaginable, to possibilities of survival that seem as unimaginable and undesirable as breathing water, because what's marked on our maps as breathing water is what everyone else just calls swimming, being in the current of a living world rather than building ourselves fortresses of safety and imagining that we're on some kind of solid ground. So maybe 24 years after I started that zine, I finally got an answer for what it means to be learning how to drown. I might actually have to do issue 4. Thank you for listening to The Great Humbling. If you're new to the podcast, we'd invite you to check out the journey we've been on over the earlier episodes. In series 1, we explored the sense-making stories taking shape through the first months of the pandemic. And series 2 tracked the altered states of consciousness, being and feeling that we were seeing around us. This is an open-ended process, and we're keen to hear from you. So please do comment, ask questions, and respond via our Facebook page, The Great Humbling, or on Twitter, where Ed is at @frucool. We're grateful to all of you who've been giving ratings, reviews, and recommendations and sharing this podcast along your networks. And if you want to get deeper into the territory we explore in these conversations, do check out aschoolcalledhome.org, where you can sign up for live online courses and events. These are extraordinary times, a moment of initiation at a cultural scale. So thank you for being with us on this emergent journey.